ready, please grab the two handouts. Tonight's class will not be long.
It's focused like a laser beam. And the local professor has to drive the program. I've been trying to get a case in Brooklyn all week. Anybody here from Brooklyn? I am an upstate boy. I like Brooklyn. It is hip. It's cool. I love people. But trying a case in Brooklyn for this upstate boy, and I've tried cases all over the country, is an adventure. Now, you're from Brooklyn. Do you think that they let you get a word in edgewise? Matter of fact, for the first time in my professional 32-year career, before the judge, I had to raise my hand at the counsel's table, and he said, "Mr. Farley, would you like to be heard?" I said, "Hey, you know, the filibuster on the other side of my co-counsel, but I think it's important, since we're bringing the action, that you ask me, listen." The judge laughed so hard he almost fell out of the chair. We won, but I'm still on top. Anyway, so I got to grow up. That's not my abbreviated class. It's an abbreviated class because we don't have a class next week. Why? Thanksgiving! Turkey time! One of my favorite holidays. As you can see from my waistline, my wife is an outstanding cook. I really love Thanksgiving. She takes good care of us. Anyway,
we're going to have a good time today.
We're going to talk about how you transfer real property. Many of you here wish someday to own your own home, whether it be a house, condominium, or some other form of real property. Tonight, you're going to learn how to do it. Or you may inherit property from some other person and wish to sell it. Tonight, you're going to learn how to do it. That's what our exercise is on. Who wants to be a homeowner? And it's all about how you do it in practical terms. Okay? It's not overly complex in the law. We're going to walk you through step by step the things you got to do. Okay. Last time, we talked about three things. Fixtures. Fixtures are simple things. You take a piece of personal property and attach it to the real property. If you attach it, it's a fixture. You detach it, it becomes personal property once again. It can go back and forth as a result. You take down her garage, it becomes personal. You attach it, it becomes real, which is a fixture.
Remember that you can exclude fixtures in the sale.
We'll talk about that briefly tonight. But you got right in the contract. Because if you're silent, they're assumed to go with the real property. So if you have that big screen television hooked up that you always wanted to the wall, costing you $35,000, it costs. Better write it in the contract, or else someone else is going to be enjoying the Giant game sitting watching your TV. You don't want it, okay? Adverse possession, very simple. Coaching. It's all about the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations say
You have a limited period of time to bring an action to defend what's yours. Under New York State law, that period of time is 10 years. If somebody is taking your property, you have 10 years to bring that action. If somebody is trespassing that property, you have 10 years to bring that action. If they meet the coaching requirements, and they have to meet all of them, for 10 years, not 9 years and 364 days. It's got to be 10 years, and it's got to be continuous for 10 years. If you meet the continuous, open, actual claim of right, hostile, exclusive, and notorious, guess what? You can take that property because of the fact that the statute of limitations will have run and they don't have the right to enforce an action against you. Okay? Now, as we said, a couple of exceptions. If the person is in the Army, Navy, they're in the hospital, they're in prison, if they cannot defend their rights, that time is what we call toll. It doesn't mean that you can't advance it, because when they get out of prison, when they get out of the Army, guess what? The clock begins again. It's like when you hit the pause button watching your favorite show. When you unpause it, the clock begins again. Similarly, if you're adversely possessing a piece of property next to your home and you sell your home, the new person who takes the home can add your time to adversely possessing it. It's called tacking. So if you're adversely possessing a piece of your neighbor's property and a new person buys your property and there is no break in the continuity, it's got to be continuous, okay? The sale does not break the continuity, okay? Because the second of the transfer, that person, if they turn around and if they adversely possess it, guess what? That's called tacking, and they get the 10 years, okay? Tolling is when you hit the pause button. Tacking is just like what you would do. You would add somebody else's time, years. Okay? Now, I want to come back to adverse possession in a minute because it relates to trespass. But let's talk for 1 second about a non-possessory interest. Remember, real property is so valuable, wealth, power, life, that we allow you to be able to sell the right to use the property even if you don't possess it. So if you have oil in your backyard, you can sell a profit to the oil company and let them drill the oil out of your yard. They are not possessing your property. You still have it. You can still graze Elsie the cow, still have Sonny the dog run out there, you can cut the grass, you can do whatever you want, but you're giving the right to the oil company to extract. Similarly, anybody here from Northern New York, Watertown, those regions, if you go to a place in Northern New York called the Tug Hill Plateau, you will see 500 windmills. There's windmills everywhere. They're on every single farm, multiple farms. The farmers are still farming. The windmill is in the middle of the corn. The farmers provide an easement to the windmill.
for the right to be able to use it. It's kind of a modified profit. Okay? They call them leases, but they're really not leasing the land, because the farmer's still using it. And with a lease, you don't get to use the property. We'll get to that landlord tenant. If you lease, do you lease a property? Anybody here tenants? Okay. Can your landlord walk in on you and say, what's the Thanksgiving dinner I'm going to send to your table?
Actually, that's in my lease statement. Yeah.
Really? Okay. Anybody else have a normal lease? Okay. Can your landlord walk in and have Thanksgiving dinner at your table without your permission?
No.
No. Okay. I want to see that lease. Got it.
Okay. Oh, great.
There's something known as the doctrine of quiet enjoyment. We'll get to this when we do real property, whereby if I lease the property, you get only input rights. You get exclusion. Okay? Your landlord cannot come in the middle of the night and say, hey, I want to watch that mystery TV. Okay? Even though he owns technically the property. When he leases that, he gives you those input rights. When you have an easement, a non-possessory interest, you're just giving them the right to use that. It's not a lease. Okay? Okay. You also have covenants and servitudes. Those are negative. What they will say is you cannot use your property to the full level. You can't build a wall so I can't see my beautiful view. The difference between a covenant and servitude is one is a contract where you run with the land and you have the agreement. I turn around and say, hey, I'll pay you, Kyle, $500 and you won't build a fence. You said, I have never had any intention. Sounds good to me. With $500, I'm all good. Okay? That's a contract. And as a result of that, that's a covenant. It runs with your title. Equitable servitude, on the other hand, is something where you go to court and a court will declare that under fundamental fairness, you can't build that fence there because it'll ruin my land. Okay? Those are rare, but they exist. Equitable servitude. You think servitude, think equity. Okay. One last thing. We're going to talk about ejectment when we get to trespass. Because that is the remedy for adverse possession. If you are trying to adversely possess somebody's property, they can sue you. Get off my yard. Get off my land. That action is ejectment. We're going to talk about that next time after Thanksgiving when we talk about trespass. And I got a cool story to tell you. Okay, let's get on to tonight.
Tonight is all about how we transfer property.
Conveyances is the term used in the law. Conveyance is a mechanism to get from here to there. Matter of fact, a lot of times, if you read Old English, they call a conveyance a carriage or a horse, some means of a vehicle to take you from one place to another. Okay? When you convey something, you are going from one place to another. With real property, a conveyance is a transfer. You're taking the land from you and giving it over to somebody else. It's real property. We no longer do the livery of season. We have a whole bunch of rules all outlined in here, and it's the acronym Commander, CMDR, contract, mortgage,
deed and record it. That commander dance is how you transfer real property. It's straightforward. It's simple. Lawyers try to make it, particularly in law school, complex. It's really not. But because property is so valuable, they can put all kinds of conditions on it. As a result, mortgages can be 8 different kinds of things. Okay? You can put all kinds of different language in the contract. So you can make it as complicated as you want. But the fundamental conveyance is straightforward. You have those four elements. Now, if you're doing a cash transaction, there's no mortgage. But there'll always be contract, deed, and recording. Because real property is so valuable, there is very few transactions without mortgages. Mortgages are almost always involved because of the cost. That doesn't mean they have to be. If you are Bill Gates, you're not going to take out a mortgage usually to buy a piece of property because you've got a lot of cash in the bank. Okay. Commander! When I was a kid, long time ago, back in the Soviet, there was a guy on television who called himself Commander Ralph. He literally would dress up like this guy. He was never in the Navy, but he dressed up in full hat and uniform at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and show cartoons. He loved by everyone. Because he's just a very friendly, kind of silly guy, and he'd show all the cartoons. Commander Ralph was talked in to running for public office because everybody loved the guy. You would watch all his cartoons, he had a big smile, he was very friendly, he didn't abuse children, this was a friendly guy, okay? When he ran, he had no political ideology. He didn't care, he just loved everybody. He won, like, every vote when he ran. He ran over Rensselaer across the river. Commander Ralph, he's the man. Ralph Vardigan was his name. And I'll tell you, he was in office as a county legislator for about 30 years in Rensselaer. And he was just like, never lost, never got any controversy. He just was a sweet guy. Everybody loved him. They all went to Commander Ralph to play some more cartoons. With this guy, he's in charge of contracts, mortgages, deeds, and recordings. Let's talk about contracts because it's the fundamental element. Under New York State law, any transfer of real property must be in writing. There's a state law known as the Statute of Frauds. Many of you may have heard about it if you ever took contracts here. The Statute of Frauds provides that any sale of real property must be in writing and must be signed by the parties to be charged. What does that mean? Remember, because real property is so valuable, wealth, power, and life, we stress that. It's going to be on the text, too. Okay? Real property, wealth, power, and life, you have very special laws of real property. And as a result, because every piece of real property is individual, no piece of property has that beautiful tree you really love.
No other piece of property has that lovely stream. No other piece of property has that nice swale in Union Flat. Because of that, you have the ability to get what they call specific performance. Specific performance says if the buyer doesn't want to buy, changes their mind, or if the seller doesn't want to sell, changes their mind, either can sue each other to enforce the contract. That is not the case with personal property. If I have a contract with you to buy your car, okay? Both parties generally don't sign that contract. And if you decide not to sell me that car, I can sue you for damages because maybe I was getting a sweet deal on that car when we had a written contract. But I can't force you to sell me that car. Why? Most cars, unless it's some kind of tripped out race car or something, are mass produced. So I can go and get another one. I don't have to buy your car. But with real property, because it's so special and unique, I can force you as the seller to sell it to me. And the buyer can force the seller can force the buyer to buy it. Both sides can enforce the contract. And as a result of that, unlike many other contracts, both parties sign it because you get specific performance. If you look at the contract, and I urge you to look at the contract as we go through. It starts on what is page 7. The page numbers are on the side and bottom. Contract for purchase and sale of residential real estate. If you look, each page is initialed by both parties. And on the last page, it is signed by both parties. Now, if you buy this as tenants in the entirety, husband and wife, you notice there's two signature lines, okay? One for husband, one for wife, okay? Similarly, if you are buying property from tenants in the entirety, both of them sign the contract, not just one. They both have to sign, okay? That's why. Because of specific performance and statute of frauds. The contract is an entity which describes in detail what you're buying. The contract is not the deed. The deed comes later, but the contract contains all the elements of the deed. What does that mean? If you're going to be buying it as tenants in entirety, both parties sign the contract. So when I went to buy my house, my wife signed it with me. When I went to sell my house, my wife signed the contract to sell with me. All the parties to it, if you buy a piece of property with 8 other people, everybody's got to sign it. Everybody has got a right in that contract. As you can see, this contract's very specific. Specific contracts avoid problems. Obviously,
standard fixtures are included in that. That's New York State law. Every contract for the sale of real property, if you're selling a home, has to have a stove. It doesn't have to have a great stove. It can have a piece of crap stove. As long as it turns on and you got a burner, it's all good. My wife was in love with her stove on our first house. When we sold the house, we took the stove with us. We wrote that in the contract, but we had to replace it with an old stove because you cannot sell the house without a stove in it. Okay? So we had a stove, I think one burner worked, it was the old one, we replaced it, but we took ours with us. Remember, left that darn chandelier, but we took the stove. You can tell who wears the pants in my pants. One of the things that the contract specifies is marketable title. What does that mean? In the contract, you say you have the right to sell. Marketable title means you own it. You cannot sell my house. I cannot sell your house. You can sell your house to me. I can sell my house to you. But we can't sell each other's houses. Okay? Why? I don't have title to your house. But in that contract, you demonstrate that you have the right to sell it, and you say that you're going to sell it free from doubt, and in the manner that you wish to sell it. What is that? That's the words of purchase and the words of limitation. The words of purchase is to who you sell it. Okay? Words of limitation is the manner. Are you putting conditions on that? All this stuff will end up in the deed, but it's in the contract first. So if you're selling your home, saying, guess what, there's a condition, you have to keep it as a pig farm, guess what, that's got to be in a contract too, not just surprise, here's the deed with that condition in it. Okay? Why? If you do not put it in a contract, regardless of the deed that you give, the property is considered in fee simple absolute. You have to put it not only in the deed, you have to put it in the contract. Both of them. Okay? Alright. Under New York State law, you will see everywhere that I'm selling you this home, quote, as is. That I'm not making representations to you that this is, you know, one of the things our president wants to do is say, this is the greatest thing in the history of the universe. This is the worst thing in the history of the universe. As a person who comes from an Irish family, I can appreciate that because we do that pretty much on one side of the equation. Oh, Mom, that was the greatest dinner ever. Oh, you have the greatest coat that I ever saw. That's kind of the Irish personality that we have in our head. Okay? You're not making those representations when you're selling a house. Okay? You're saying, whatever I'm selling, you're getting. Why? Because if you make those representations, who's on the hook? The guy who's selling. Okay? So you say, as is. And you let the buyer figure out what that is. But you can't hide things. You can't turn around and know that the roof is ready to cave in because your roofing contractor after the water started pouring in last week, told you you need a new roof because the water's pouring in, you can't turn around and say, oh, we got a great roof, best one ever. You have to disclose that known defect. Now, if you happen to know that the roof is old, but that, hey, everything seems to be working okay, you don't have to say a word. Okay? Why is that the case? Can you turn a blind eye if you don't know? Yes, you can. Because if you look at the contract, in the contract is given to the purchaser the right to provide inspections. They can hire a service to go in and inspect the house. About 3 years ago, I had a 97-year-old uncle. I'll give you a second. About 3 years ago, I had a 97-year-old uncle. He lost his wife, sadly, my aunt, loved him, he was bothering me. He turns to me and says, Bob, I have this little bitty house that I had as an investment house. I need you to sell it. He was 97 years old and he didn't have the energy to sell it. So he fell with me. This was the house from that. Okay? Nothing had been done to it for about 30 years. The tenants had lived there, no supervision whatsoever, and it basically trashed. Okay? So I go through with the realtor, step by step, and say, okay, what do we have to fix? Because I don't want to get charged with known defects. And I went down through and we saw. Well, up in the attic, they found that there was mold in the corner. Now, I don't know in upstate New York a house that doesn't have some mold in the corner in the attic, but they found it. $8,600 later, a house that was only selling for $124,000, that's the one. The guy came in with spacesuits. That's the one. But you have that because I didn't know about it. I didn't crawl in a crawl space, which was about the size of this paper. Okay? I'm a little chubby to do that. But their inspector did. He was a slender guy. Went up to the attic. He found it. He said, we're not buying a house with mold in it. So, we had a fix. Okay, you had a question. No. Well, there's certain, in order to get certain financing, or buy certain types of home, like a home, okay? They require that certain inspections be done. Generally, a bank will not finance it, will not grant a home, a mortgage, without an inspection. But the inspection, let's say both you and I have a lot of money, okay? And I go to you and I say, really like that house that you have, I want to give you $100,000 in cash. Say, come with me, only paid 84, sounds good. Do I have to do an inspection on it? No. We're not financing them. I'm giving them a cash transaction. Okay? And there's no legal requirement where I would have to do it. That being said, because land transactions are so valuable, no one wants to be left holding the bag. They don't want to buy something they don't know what they're getting. So almost all properties have inspections done. And you can see the inspection clause in the contract. And the contract is contingent upon that inspection. And if certain defects are found of a certain value, then guess what? The buyer doesn't have to buy it. Okay? So the buyer does have some degree of leverage because he's got this contingency in the contract. So when it comes to specific performance, the seller can't force him to buy it if it's got this contingency. Okay? Big ticket items are generally what's in that inspection. Now, most homes are bought and sold through realtors. A realtor is a wonderful human being. They are licensed by the state of New York. They are salespeople. They make their living off of commission. That means if you buy a $100,000 house, they will be paid $7,000 in most upstate jurisdictions. Downstate, where the value of the homes are more, their commissions generally run a little less than that, around 6 to 5,
depending on the value of
the home. The realtor works for the seller. I'm going to tell you that again, so you'll see that on the text. The realtor is an agent, an employee, who they are a contractor of the seller. Now, as a buyer, you think that realtor is your best friend. That realtor will help you out in every way. Why? They want you to buy the house. Why? Because they get paid off of the commission. Commission agents want to be nice to the people who are buying the property. They want you to pay as much as you can for it, and they want you motivated to go through the transaction. So they're going to be super helpful. Your new best friend is the realtor. That doesn't make them bad or evil people. Just know that going in, that the realtor is there to sell you something. Okay? Now, smart realtors, and you have smart and dumb realtors like you have smart and dumb people. Smart realtors are not going to push a home on you that you shouldn't or don't really want to buy. Why? Because they represent usually a lot of homes, a lot of sellers. So they'll find one that's right for you. They just want to be paid. They don't care whether they get paid by you buying this house or buying that house. They just want to be paid. Now, if they can get you to buy a much nicer house with a higher commission, Johnny, you know they want to do. Okay? But if all you can afford is a little house, take it run, baby. Realize that you can, as a buyer, hire a real estate agent. That is rarely done. Why? Because you're going to end up paying them as opposed to having the seller pay them. It's always nice to use other people's money to be able to pay them. What generally happens with what we call a buyer's broker is they split the commission because it makes the realtor easy, but they don't have to. And if you have, as a buyer, a real estate agent who represents only you, you are responsible for paying whatever commission they're going to charge. Usually their commission for a buyer's broker is half of that of a realtor in selling. Okay, so usually goes from 7% for selling to 3.5% for buying. A buyer's broker is rare. Okay? But you can do it. Okay. Any questions on the contract? The realtor is generally the person who deals with the buyer. As the seller, you generally do not deal with them. You hire somebody to do that for you. So the realtor
generally provide the buyer with a contract. The real estate boards of every county, and realtors are a state regulated entity. You have to be licensed by the state to take a test. By the way, if you're a lawyer, you don't have to take that test, because it comes with your law degree. Okay? It comes with your bar. But otherwise, if you're not an attorney, you have to take a test to be licensed as a realtor. Okay? And as the realtor, you represent the seller. So you will get the contract from the realtor in 99% of the circumstances. Okay? That contract is usually pretty standard. Why? Most realtors are not lawyers. So they use the contract that the average person in the county will use through the real estate board. Now, if I'm selling a $2 million house, do I want my realtor to use the same contract that they'll use on every $100,000 house? No, because I'll probably have certain things that I want to exclude or certain things that I want to include. And as a result of that, the higher the price of the house, the higher the value, the more individualized the contract is. Frequently, then, the seller will go to a lawyer, have them write up a special contract that the realtor will provide to the potential buyers. But in most middle-class transactions, the middle-class operations or reduced-cost areas, you have the realtor use a pretty standard contract. That's okay in much of the degree. You have to fill in the blanks, but those contracts are tested. Okay? They're approved by the real estate board who have had a lot of experience selling houses. So whereas many form contracts are pretty bad, form contracts on a real estate board are not bad. They've been tested, they've had a lot of, they're not typically a seller-friendly contract. Why? Because the real estate board represents everybody. And remember, they're representing the realtors on a real estate board, and what do the realtors want to do? Sell houses. That's how they make their money. So as a result of that, the contracts they usually present are right down the middle. If you look at the real estate board, the contract that I provided you is pretty much what the standard contract is in Schenectady County. And if you go from county to county, they're not much different, okay? Because one real estate board will see a crack. Now, some counties have certain specific things that that county will require. In the Hudson Valley, there's a lot of counties that require certain environmental testing, okay? Why? Because a lot of areas don't have sewers, and they're worried about septic systems, so as a result of that, they have certain perk test requirements for the environment. Most places up here don't have the same challenges, so you won't have that. Nor in the city of New York. Why? Everybody in the city of New York generally has sewers. Okay? They have sanitary sewers, they don't have septic tank issues. So as a result of that, they can be a little tweaked county to county, but not that much. Okay. Most people, as we said, do not buy their home for cash. Most people don't have the $200,000 to buy an average home in their pocket. So what do? They have to borrow the money. That's what a mortgage is. The mortgage is the legal instrument by which the real estate can be financed. Just like the contract, it must
be in writing. It too must describe the land and the parties. And like all other contracts, because the mortgage is a contract, the mortgage is a contract between the buyer and the finance entity, usually a bank, could be a mortgage provider. There are mortgage bankers who aren't technically banks, but that is where the contract is. Most mortgages are identical, whether you go to Citibank, Trustful Bank, First National Bank of Podunk, it does not matter. You look at those mortgages, unless it's a very high-end specialty mortgage, you're buying a $30 million house, you go to a private mortgage bank, okay, that can be a little different. But if you buy a regular house, most mortgages are identical. Yes?
What does it mean to remortgage?
Sorry?
What does it mean to exactly?
We'll talk about that. When you are buying a home for the first time and getting a mortgage to be able to buy it, okay, buy a new property, have it owned before, that mortgage really doesn't matter where you get it. The differences between the finance agencies are typically cost. Trustco might be offering a lower rate than First National Bank of Florida. Okay? Mortgages are very competitive. But why are the language in the mortgage document in your contract almost always the same? Doesn't make sense. I go to one bank, you open an account, the differences in the account terms generally are different from one bank to another. While our mortgage is usually almost identical. Because most banks don't what we call originate their mortgages. What does that mean? They immediately will take the mortgage after you close the house and sell it on the secondary mortgage market. That way, what they'll do, let's say you have a 5% interest rate, they'll sell it on the secondary mortgage rate to the secondary mortgage companies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They'll sell it to those entities at a discount. So instead of keeping the mortgage and letting me pay me 5% every mortgage payment, I'll sell the paper to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and they'll pay me 4 3/4, not out of it, on the whole amount. Fannie and Freddie, which are government-sponsored enterprises, okay? They were created by the federal government. There's actually 12 of them. The biggest ones are Fannie and Freddie. Okay? One was created in 1933. The other one was created in 1969. What they wanted to do was provide banks with capital so they could go out and mortgage things. But because the banks don't want to keep that money tied up for 30 years, which is the standard mortgage, they sell it on the secondary market, and in order to do that, Fannie and Freddie have terms they have to put in their mortgage, so they'll buy it. That is why almost every mortgage document's the same, because they all want to sell it to Fannie and Freddie. They have to follow their rules in order to sell it. So if you get the mortgage from Trustco, you'll read it, and the terms are almost identical from the one you get if you apply to the First National Bank of Podunk. It's because both Trustco and First National Bank of Podunk want to sell to Fannie and Freddie, they have terms that go on the mortgage, they basically write their mortgage document for them. Okay? Now, those terms can get you into trouble as a society sometimes, because Fannie and Freddie, which are federally sponsored corporations, they're not part of the federal government, even though their boards are appointed by the president. They're private enterprise entities. They can change what the standards are for the mortgages. 2000s, they lightened the requirements for a mortgage. For basically 50 years from the Depression, when you had a lot of mortgage foreclosures, most banks learned that you ought to put 20% down on your home so you'd only finance 80% of it. You have to have some skin in the game. Well, Fannie and Freddie said, you know, we want more people to be able to buy homes, and as a result of that, we think that only 5% should be put down. What happened? People were buying homes they couldn't afford. They were getting foreclosed on. It wasn't the banks, per se, or the financing entities that caused that mortgage crisis. It was Fannie and Freddie. Why? Because, well, the intention, they wanted more people to buy homes. That's a good policy. The problem is, you're not doing anybody a favor who goes out and buys a home they can't afford. If you only put 5% down, we may not be able to afford the other 95%. And experience for 50 years in this country said, put down 20%. Now, there's ways that we saw for those 50 years to actually lessen that burden. You can buy something known as private mortgage insurance. That means you put down the 5% and then you buy an insurance policy saying, I'm going to pay extra every month until I get to that 20% level. PMI is expensive, private mortgage insurance, but it guarantees the person is qualified because they won't give you the PMI unless you can afford it. Okay? You saw a huge uptake in foreclosures after Fannie and Freddie lowered the standards. Every bank knew this was coming. They had been lending money in mortgages for some for 200 years, some for only 50 since the Depression, but they had a lot of experience saying, this isn't going to end well. But if they wanted to sell it on a secondary mortgage market, they had to follow what Fannie and Freddie said. So they said, I'm you guys, so they issued those mortgages. The people who got their homes foreclosed through the mortgage crisis that happened in the 2000s were because they couldn't afford their home. When they turn around and say that it was predatory lending, that really was a tiny part of the problem. It was that people were buying homes they couldn't afford. Now, when you have an appreciating market, that means you buy the house for 100 grand, and 3 years later it's worth 130. Okay? That's an appreciating market. Housing values are going up. You don't have a problem with foreclosures. Why? Because the house is now worth more than what you paid for it. You have that natural growth. What happened was, perfect store. Fannie and Freddie lowered their requirements. I now put down 5% on an $800,000 home when I'm making $42,000 a year. This isn't going to end well. And combined with that, it went from an appreciating market to a depreciating market. I'm on the hook for an $800,000 home, which is now worth went down. That's when you have a mortgage crisis. Because if your home is appreciating, you turn around and sell the house, you actually make money. If it's in a depreciating market, because you sign the mortgage document, New York State is what we call a deficiency state. So if they foreclosed a home and you bought it for $800,000 and borrowed $700,000 and it's now worth $4,000, even after they foreclose on the home, you owe $300,000. You have no home, plus you owe $300,000. Okay? Not every state is the same, but New York State is a deficiency state. In a lot of other states, they walk away from their mortgage because they don't have to pay a deficiency. They just lose the home. New York State, you don't have abandoned homes much. Why? Because you have to pay the deficiency. So you try to get all you can out of that house. The best thing you can do if you are underwater is try to refinance, turn around and get the home sold so you get out of the mortgage responsibility. Interestingly enough, Fannie and Freddie, after all this was over, said, oops, sorry, made a boo-boo, went back to the historic requirements, now you're back up to 20% again for the standard mortgage to be able to sell. So they went back to the pre-2000 standards. They recognized they cost it. So they then tried to fix it. But hurt a lot of people amongst the way. Okay?
I don't know that it was purposeful, because again, they were trying to get more people in the homes. That's a great thing to do, but you don't help somebody when you get them into a home they can't afford. Okay, what kind of mortgages are out there? The question was asked earlier, what about a home equity loan? Okay? You have first and second mortgages. The first mortgage is the mortgage you take to buy the property. So I don't have a home, I want to buy a home, I go to the bank, they lend me money to buy the home. I either put 20% down or I get PMI with 5%. By the way, a FHA mortgage, Federal Housing Administration, is a special type of mortgage, usually on lower cost properties. They will allow a 5% mortgage, but you have to jump through a million hoops on qualifications in order to show it. So they don't have you buying a house you can't afford. But with most mortgages, you put down a 20%, you get the 80%, and that is your first mortgage, okay? If I buy the house for $100,000, can't get much of a house for $100,000 anymore, but round numbers, okay? That means the bank's gonna give you $80,000 and you're gonna put down $20,000. That is your first mortgage. Over time, you start to pay off the mortgage, okay? So now instead of owing, after 15 years, you have a 30-year mortgage, you pay off some of the mortgage, you now only owe $75,000. The house has appreciated up to $150,000. That means instead of having only 3/4 of it paid off, you have half of it paid off. Okay? Why? Because you've got equity in that home. You can go to a bank and say, by the way, my kid needs to go to college. I need a new car. I want to put a pool in my backyard.
mother-in-law's living in my basement. Let's see if we can buy her, build her a little cottage outside. Okay? You can get a second mortgage on your property. That's your home equity loan. Okay? You can borrow up to that percentage of the equity in your house on it. Okay? So whereas you have $75,000, they'll generally lend you up to a certain percentage. Home equity loans are more risky than first mortgages. Okay? As a result, they tend to have higher requirements. Now, most mortgages are what we call amortized. That means your first payment, dollar for dollar, is the same as your last. Most people borrow on their first mortgage for a term of 30 years. It's the standard mortgage. You can get a 15-year mortgage. You can get a 45-year mortgage, but they're rare. Most people don't get a 45-year mortgage because that's a long, long time, and you know you might be in a nursing home by the time you pay that off. Most people don't get a 15-year mortgage because you're paying a higher payment because you've got the money over 15 years, not over 30. But realize a 15-year mortgage is substantially less than a 30-year mortgage would be as far as its financing costs. Why? Because the bank has its money for at risk for half the time. So even though you're paying more, you're not paying twice as much. Okay? And you get it paid off quicker. My first home I bought for $88,000. I bought it through the newspaper without a realtor, and I got a 15-year mortgage. Why? I was able to pay off that small amount of money over 15 years. I only owned a house for five, but I was able to pay it off over 15 years. 15-year mortgages are much more affordable if you can do it, but a lot of people can't afford it. Okay? If you're buying your home, even if it's your first home, frequently you go 30 years. So with an amortized mortgage, your first payment, day one, is going to be the same as the last payment on 30 years. But if, per se, your mortgage payment is $1,000 every month, first month, first year, going to be $1,000. Last month, 30 years, going to be $1,000. But the banks want to get their interest up front. So your first payment, even though it's $1,000, it's 1 cent of principal, and $999.99 of interest. Your last payment is going to be $999.99 of principal and 1 cent of interest. The banks want to get their money up front. This becomes especially important with issues of foreclosure. Why? Because if they foreclose on the property early, you haven't paid a lot of principal down. You pay a lot of interest down. That's why the banks want to have this out early. Okay? Because if something goes out quickly, they've got more of their money back. Okay? The principal is what it is. They want to get their interest.
So with an amortized loan, every payment is the same, but the percentage of that payment is not. This is also important because of taxes. Why? Under federal law, all interest expense of
to a threshold, is deductible off your income tax. So your first mortgage payment, $999.99, is deductible off your federal income tax. So basically, when you first buy your home, you're getting a huge tax deduction. Usually when you need it most, because you're divorced, which is not. Okay? Last time you turn around and run your last payment, you're getting one penny in a tax deduction. Now by that time, hopefully you're doing better. But to your point, what is a way to get more of a tax deduction? Refinance the home. Because what happens when you refinance it? Starts the clock again. So if you turn around and refinance the home, let's say you have $100,000 left on your loan. Okay? If you keep paying that payment, you're going to get less and less of a tax deduction, right? Why? Because it's starting day one. I turn around and refinance it, the clock starts back day one. So your first payment on the refinance, again, $999, or $999 of interest. So it restarts the clock. It's one of the reasons why people refinance homes, particularly when the interest rates are going down, because they save on the interest rate and they get a bigger tax deduction. Now, mortgage is a contract. You can structure it any way you want. As a result of that, you can pay an amortized payment, $1,000 every month for 30 years. Or you can say, look, I'm young, I can't afford $1,000 every month, I know that I will grow in my career, make more money, so what I agree, bank, if you agree, is I'm going to pay you $500 a month, and in the last payment, instead of paying $500, I'm going to pay off the balance of the mortgage. So you have to make a huge payment at the end. That's called a balloon payment. Why? It goes like this, okay? Balloon payments are not as bad as you might imagine. How the heck are you going to come up with that huge amount of money? Guess what? Refinance. Okay? Come back in. Assume mortgages don't exist anymore. They were really big in the 1970s. Because mortgage rates were going through the roof. Whereas mortgage rates currently are around 4 or 5%, back then, when I sat in these chairs, mortgage rates were 21%. Okay? They were astronomically high. So if the owner of the home that you're buying has a mortgage that he's paying 5% because he got it in the 1960s, I turn to you and say, look it, how about you just let me assume your mortgage? Because you're paying 5% of that money, not 22%. And I'll take a mortgage at the high interest rate for the balance. So I take a secondary mortgage to start. Banks were getting screwed out of their interest as a result of that practice. Okay? Now, in the 1960s, 4 or 5% interest rates, just like today, were commonplace. They didn't care if you assumed the mortgage. Why? Because the next year would be 4 or 5%. They didn't get any difference as long as they got their money. When the 1970s came along and interest rates were going high, they said, I want you to take the full 21%. So they started writing in their mortgages something called a due-on-sale clause. So when you sell your house, you no longer get to assume the mortgage, you got to pay it off. Okay? You can't transfer it to it. That's why assumed mortgages are very rare, because
The banks got burned in the 1970s, so all the new mortgages after that, they wrote a due on sale clause that takes it out. So an assumed mortgage is a very rare animal. They do exist, but people have to pay a lot more for them, and they're not useful because you can just refinance. Lastly, a purchase money mortgage. What's the purchase money mortgage? Instead of going to the bank, the homeowner provides the financing. Okay? So if you buy my house, instead of going to the bank, I'll give you the money to buy the house. Okay? Instead of paying me the $100,000 all at once, you pay me $1,000 a month for 30 years. Okay? That's a purchase money mortgage. I had a home up in Indian Lake, New York, in the middle of the Adirondacks, and nobody wanted to buy it. It was my father's family home, and I got, just like my uncle, I got the beauty of having a son. It was literally, I think if you lean too hard on the house, and collapsed. Nobody really wanted to buy a great piece of property, but the house itself, really not been lived in since the 1950s. The winters are rather harsh up there. Wasn't a really great home to buy. Okay? Property great. The only way we could get somebody to buy it was to give them a purchase money mortgage. Somebody paid $42,000, and we let them pay us for 4.5 years. We financed it, we sold it, it's done. Okay. Purchase money mortgages are generally done in commercial transactions because people usually don't have that level of funds. But sometimes, as I said, if you want to get rid of a property, it's a way to do it. Okay. What are the differences in your mortgages as far as the rates? A prime rate mortgage is not the best rate. It's the going rate. It's the market rate. Right now, prime rate mortgages are going about 4 to 5%. They fluctuate. My very first home, that home I bought for $88,000, I got a sweetheart deal that only paid 18% on my loan. Okay? Mortgage rates at that time were in the 20s. I got a good deal, shopped around, actually got a less mortgage. Only owned the house for 3 years, made a profit, called it a day. Okay? Today, most mortgages are running the average market rate, as I said, between 4 and 5%. It's competitive, shop around, and get it. Fixed rate mortgages mean that your mortgage rate will never change over the term of the contract. So if you get that 4% mortgage, for the first month it's 4%, for the last month it's 4%, all across the time of the mortgage. With a variable rate mortgage, they float with the market. So if the market rates go up to 6, your first payment may have been at 4, but now it's at 6. Why? Because the market goes up and down. If the market goes down, you make out. If the market goes up, you don't. You pay more. Why do most people look at a variable rate mortgage? Because banks, in order to entice you with that, banks, finance entities like variable rates. They don't get stuck over a 30-year period with a bad rate. It's going to adjust with whatever the market is. So they tend to offer what they call an introductory rate, which is below market rate. That is a subprime mortgage. A subprime mortgage says, take it for this introductory rate of 3, but after 2 years, it's going to adjust to whatever the market rate. So your first payments are at 3%, but your last payment may be at 18%. Depends on whatever the market is. Okay? That's where people could also get underwater because that market can change. Interest rates have been pretty steady They had gone from a low of about 3 in recent years to a high of 6. That's a much more compressed rate than they were in the 70s and early 80s, where, as I said, they got up as high as 24%. You haven't seen that in a generation, thank God. A convertible mortgage is kind of the best of all possible worlds. For a set fee, you can take the variable rate and convert it. This is the mortgage option I took as a young man. Why? On the home that I own now, I was not making a lot of money. I was pretty modest in my salary. And I took an introductory rate of 4%. Market rates back then were about 6 and 7. And I took that introductory rate where I could convert it to whatever the market rate was going to be within a 5-year period for a $250 fee. Not a lot of money compared to how much you were saving. I knew, or at least it looked like, you never know in the future, that market rates were going to go down. So I locked a rate in it at 4%. So my first introductory rate was at 3, went up to 6, then down to 4, came up to 50, at a 4% rate for the remaining 30 years. Okay? That was a good thing for me. Now, it could have backfired. What happened if the interest rates went up? I could have converted it before it hit high, but boy, you're taking a risk. At the end of the day, it's a gamble. It's not the end of the world, though. Why? You can always, always refinance. So even if you have a bad interest rate, you can generally refinance it and get it down. You may not get it down to where you want it to, but you can get it down generally. Okay. As we talked about, the due on sale clause prevents the assumable mortgage. Foreclosure is when you don't pay the mortgage and the bank takes your property by means of a judicial action where they sue you to say, give me my money. We are a deficiency state, so if you owe more than the house sold for at auction at the foreclosure, you owe the balance. So you no longer have a house, plus you owe the balance. As we said, the two major government-sponsored enterprises that buy the secondary mortgages are Federal National Mortgage Association, that's called Fannie Mae, chartered during the Great Depression in 1938. Why did we do this? Why did Roosevelt, who was president, create this organization? Because banks were issuing mortgages. They were afraid to turn around and have their money out there. By creating this entity bought those mortgages and gave banks money to lend for home mortgage purposes. It worked out beautifully. So much for that by 1969, says 70, it was actually chartered in 69, came into effect in 70, Richard Nixon said, we've had so much growth, they can't do everything, so we created a second one, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation called Freddie Mac. Okay? They set the mortgage underwriting requirements. That's why, again, most of the mortgages contain the same language. Okay. Now, we no longer do livery of season. So we have a deed. People now can read and write. You
can look at the deed in this. See the mortgage in here too. But you can look at the deed in your packet. The deed is very simple. It has the words, starts off this indentation. Most deeds today are on the internet. You just jump on your local county clerk's website, pull it down, print it off. When I first started practicing law, you just have to march yourself down to the county, talk to the little blue-haired old ladies who were standing behind the counter, and we're all lovely and come great care of you, and ask them for the deed. They go to the dusty old books, literally blow the dust off of it, make a photocopy of it, and give it to you. Today, you can do it all from your lovely computer, just print it off. But what is in the deed? It has certain formalities. It does the modern job of delivery of season. Just like the mortgage, just like the contract, the statute of fraud says it must be in writing. It must describe the land and the parties. It has those words of purchase, who it goes to, as well as the words of limitation. If it's fee simple absolute, it is to Bob for life. If it has a condition, that condition will follow it. Okay? So if it's a fee simple absolute, no conditions, fee simple determinable, fee simple subject to a condition subsequent, they have conditions in them. Life estate, for Bob for life. Okay? Or for Bob for the life of Aunt Tilda. Okay? Pour entre vin. The deed tells the tale. Under New York State law, deeds used to be sealed. That means they used to have that wax seal on it. If you look at the deed, it now has a photocopy of a wax seal on it. It's unnecessary by law, but deeds are instruments that people pay a lot of money for. Why? Because it shows that you own the house. Okay? So they still have that photocopy of the seal on it. Those little dots on the side. Okay? But we no longer require somebody to be done the last. A signature is required from the grantor. A deed is not a contract. A deed is not a contract. One more time. A deed is not a contract. It is not signed by both parties. Why? It is evidence of what you are getting. That's all it is. It's an attestation, a promise by the grantor, the person selling the property, of what you're getting. Okay? That's why it must be signed by the grantor. Okay? Not signed by the grantee. A deed takes effect and title transfers upon physical delivery. So when I give you that deed is when you take possession of the property. Okay? Even if you don't give me the check before. So what is the very last thing that generally happens at closing? The deed is given over. Okay. Why not before? Because the title is actually passed when that deed is transferred. So technically, although it will be
could be in breach of contract and get sued, the title to the property becomes yours when that deed is transferred. It has to be done physically.
Delivery is presumed if handed to the grantee. Okay? Now,
there are certain covenants that's promises, right? In a deed.
The number one thing is marketable title. And the way that this is guaranteed is one of three ways. A general warranty deed says, you're getting everything that I promised you in that property, getting all the rights, peace, and blessings, and I'm guaranteeing it. I'm giving everything to you because I guarantee it. A special warranty deed has some exceptions. That is rare. It doesn't happen much. Why?
If you're buying a piece of property, do you want exceptions? No. You want to get absolutely everything, and you want the guy who's selling it to promise you you're getting exactly what you're paying.
So general warranty deeds are 99% of the deeds. What is a quitclaim deed?
A quitclaim deed is where you have a question on the title. I don't know what my rights are in the land, but whatever I got, you're dead. Now, do you really want to buy a piece of property where you don't know anything? Most people don't. But if you get it at a steep discount, say, I don't know, but I'll sell it to you cheap. Some people are willing to take that risk. This is not much of a risk anymore. Why? The internet.
Title searches and title insurance are purchased when you buy a home.
That title insurance is an insurance policy bought by the buyer to say everything the seller says is true. And if it's not, you don't have the right to sell me that house and piece of plastic. The title insurance company, which is an insurance company, will pay me for any damages I suffer as a result. Can't get that specific performance from them, but you can get money. And how does the title insurance be able, the company, sell that to you for a reasonable price? They do a title search. They go back and they see that Matilda sold it to Joe, Joe sold it to Tom, and Tom sold it to the people you're buying from. And they can see that it was all done in a piece of lassie. You know, as I said, when I started my career, I used to have to do that by going to the dusty shelves of the county clerk's office. Look through these books that are like this big and open them up to the page in 1799 when the property was first subdivided out of the property. Today, rather much easier. Why? Hop on the internet, boom, you can find that deed that was recorded back before you bought the property. That's what title insurers do. They do a title search. Then they'll write the title insurance policy.
So, unlike previous years, the general warranty deed is less important because of the fact that you don't sue the seller anymore, you just get the title insurance. And no bank will allow a mortgage without title insurance. And, more importantly, you won't buy it, your lawyer won't let you buy it if they're a good lawyer. Without it. Okay? Okay.
Thank heavens we no longer beat up the little kid after the ceremony in the public square. Because that little kid will remember the fact that that was
the day that John bought the property from Joe. Or Harriet bought it from Bonnie. Why? Because the little kid got beaten with it in for their life and they never forgot it. We don't do that anymore, thankfully, for all three-year-olds. Instead, you file the deed in a process known as recording with the county clerk. The county clerk is the repository for all records. It's the legal process whereby the whole free world is notified that the real property has been conveyed. Recording is important. Why? Because it prevents people from selling the property more than once. If the property sale is not recorded, how do you know that that person who's selling you the property didn't run down the street and then sell it to somebody else? As a result, we have in New York State a recording requirement in order to enforce your rights as a landowner. It's the snooze you lose rule. So if the person turns around and sells the property to somebody else before you record it, that person can be found to be the true landowner. Why? Because you didn't put them on notice that you were the true landowner. So as a result, you can certainly sue the person who sold the property more than once. And you can go after that person, but obviously they're rather unsavory that they sell the property more than once. That's why, after a property is sold, run like hell to the county clerk's office and record it. Not only do you record the deed, but you record the mortgage and any other documents that are part of the land transaction. Give an example, if you have an easement, that gets recorded too. Okay? It's the legal means by which the purchaser can prove that they were the first to purchase the property. Because once it's recorded, and that guy sells it the second time, you say, sorry, you should have checked with the county clerk. I recorded that, sir. Okay? So the second person then is the one that's got to seek redress off the person who sells it twice, not the first one. Okay? If you don't record, it's the recorded person, not the first one. Okay? Recordation is notice. That's the purpose. Once you give notice, you're good. Again, any instrument that's part of the real property transaction can be recorded. You record the deed, you record the easements, you record the mortgage. Okay? Why? Because that way everyone is on notice for all those things. So they'll know that. If you don't, you can be responsible for any of the problems there. Okay? Mechanics of recording are simple. You got to pay a fee. On the very back of this, you will see all the fees, and there's quite a few of them. It's connected to county. Notice there is a rather substantial fee for recording a mortgage. It's a mortgage recording tax. It's several $100, not free. Okay? Recording a deed is relatively inexpensive. According to mortgage, you pay a big tax. But you have to do it because the bank requires you to do it, and you haven't satisfied your requirements under the mortgage unless you do record it. Okay? Usually, your agent at the closing, you hire a lawyer, or you have somebody work as an agent,
court office. Usually, as a landowner, don't have to go down to the county court. But someone does, and they have to pay off. You also have to file a whole bunch of tax forms. There's a state tax form, there's a county tax form for real property tax transactions.
Okay? You have to pay the remainder of the real property taxes for that year.
School taxes come out at one point in the year. They come out usually in September because that's the school year. Town and county taxes come out the first of the year. So depending on when you buy the house, you either owe the people who bought it from tax dollars that they paid for going forward for the future, or you have to pay taxes they have yet to pay. The tax man always gets their money. The question is, who's going to share that? That is part of who the land transaction. But you cannot record it unless all those taxes are paid in full.
Okay? Okay. Take a 5-minute break, come down, and we'll go through a 15-minute exercise. Okay.
Everybody got their...
What's your name?